Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is with Raoul Peck, and yes, that's Peck, same last name, and this was just an absolute treat for me. It was the kind of interview where I just didn't want to turn off the recorder, and I think my first question to Raoul was, after we ended recording, was, so when are you going to give up filmmaking, Raoul, and start teaching philosophy? We had a good laugh, and I found out a little bit more about Raoul's background and his history and development and philosophy. And I mean, it's what hasn't Raoul done, I think, is the question, really. And his film world premiered at TIFF this week, I Am Not Your Negro. It's a must-see. You are going to hear about this film. It is a brilliant piece of filmmaking. It's a statement about the way things are, the way things were, and the way things really do need to be. We talked about so many things in this interview that you're going to find not only fascinating, compelling, and engaging, but I trust and I hope that it gets you thinking about things in a new way. Raoul says that he hopes people, he doesn't want them to go away with guilt from this film, but he wants them to feel conflicted, and I think that is really a good way to put it. So check it out. Listen in. Raoul Peck, coming right up. I Am Not Your Negro is the film. World premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival, and davidpecklive.com, rabble.ca for more podcasting. If you'd like my new book, Real Change is Incremental, check it out there online. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today for a world premiere of a film that you're all going to need to see. We're here at the Toronto International Film Festival 2016. I Am Not Your Negro is the film, and we're here. I can't believe I'm actually sitting face to face, and this isn't happening via Skype or a phone call with Raoul Peck. Thank you so much for your time and,
thank you for inviting me.
It's a brilliant film. Driving home late last night. It's not the kind of film you want to see just before you go to bed. How's that?
That's true.
A couple of shots of vodka before heading to bed might have been a good idea. What was your sense as you walked out on stage, world premiere, standing ovation, just before the Q&A, before we start talking about some of the issues? Because I'm still buzzing, to be honest with you.
But, you know, that's probably one of a rare film from all the film I've made where I felt we gave ourselves all the conditions, all the time necessary to do a great job. That's why it was key for us to produce it ourselves with Remy Grelletti and Hébert Peck, my brother, and me as a third producer. And so we gave ourselves the time to find the necessary money, to find the necessary form. It took me 4 years until I knew what the film was going to be, and it took us another 6 years.
And a ten-year project.
Yeah, it's a 10-year project. I had the rights from a long time, from 10 years, from the James Baldwin estate, and they were really, really supportive of the project. They trusted us. They trusted me, and they never put any pressure on us. Not on the content, not on the time, not about what kind of film I was going to make. They knew my work, in particular Gloria Baldwin, James Baldwin's younger sister. She have seen Lumumba, and she, in fact, I think Lumumba was the key for me to, to get the rights, because she knows well the African continent. She's been in James Baldwin's first trip to Africa. She became at 21 James' personal assistant and secretary. So she went through all that period with him. So I guess there was for her a link, and it was amazing the type of freedom they gave me.
And it's quite remarkable. To what degree did it evolve? Did it change over the 10 years, or were you? It sounded to me last night in the Q&A that you were pretty committed at an early stage as to where this was heading.
Well, you know, like some of the films that you make, you know, you don't really know when it started. And
right.
I could say it started at when I was 16, when I first bumped into Baldwin. At the time, there were not many authors that I could relate to that were with whom I felt they were telling my story from my point of view. When I start reading James Baldwin, it's just matches. It's, you know, I know I got something. And there were not many books and authors that you could trust, you know. As a young black person, you distrust literature. Not that you can recognize good literature, you can recognize great stories, but at some point, you know, in the corner of a paragraph, you just realize that you were not part of the picture, that your world is not part of the picture. So you start to deconstruct whatever you're reading. You know, all great authors, you know, except for rare ones like Shakespeare. You know, when you have Othello, you can relate to that somehow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's very rare. You know, when you read Faulkner. You know, it's a mixed feeling, you know. And so James Baldwin was somehow, you know, an incredible discovery. And he educated me.
Well, you know what's amazing to me is what I was struck with was the discovery, is it fair to say the rediscovery of James Baldwin? I would imagine as a filmmaker and having worked and sort of embraced his work for the last 10 years, you must be pretty thrilled that you are now shining a light onto a writer that not necessarily has been forgotten, but even Cameron Bailey's introduction, kind of challenging the audience to say, you need to go back to this literature.
Of course,
you did the same thing
as well.
I was astounded at how prophetic and precise and authoritative and definitive.
And actual and current.
It's current.
It's talking to us today.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's incredible. And knowing that Baldwin at some point, in particular, in the late 70s and 80s, it was considered like almost a has-been, you know, by the new generation. They respected him, but you know, there were a lot of other issues, and we tend to forget that it was a real massacre after, you know, they start killing the Black Panther, the decimating their leadership, imprison them or bribing them. And then you had Martin Luther King, who became the hero, and then and they built statue about him. And then for the majority, it was like, done deal now. We don't need to have any issue. We solve every problem.
Right.
Now we have even rich black people. We have an aristocracy.
Things are better now.
Now things are better. So let's... you know, most of the writers of the mostly political writers, you can't read what they were writing at the time. But today, you can read Baldwin as if it is today. So Baldwin words have survived, and it's even more impactful today than it was.
Is. He's magical to watch, actually.
The editing, the
way you pieced it together is really truly brilliant in my mind because of his pauses, you know, on the Dick Cavett show, for instance. I mean, it's just so marvelous. I love the fact that he's just smokes everywhere, too. It's so great. Smoking on live television,
exactly,
it's fantastic.
We forgot that.
The way he deals with the philosopher's name, who I've, you know, affectionately forgotten already, but it's just with such authority.
Oh, yeah.
And hang on a minute. this is actually how it is.
Oh, yeah.
It's so wonderful how you capture
that. And he had read everything. He was very erudite. He had a very strong knowledge of literature, of the world, of politics. He traveled a lot. It's incredible what you get when you leave your country. Because you start to see the world and your own country differently. And what he says, as a black writer in America, that you can't concentrate on the typewriting, a typewriter, when all your antenna is looking in your back to make sure that, you're not being attacked or that you are in danger, basically. And he's traveling and meeting other people and confronting his view and his experience to other experience. That was key.
It's a nice connection to a line. He talks about this idea of listening as a development guy, as a guy who has spent a lot of time in the majority world. I think something I tell my students all the time, three things you need to know to be a good development worker. You need to listen. You need to listen. And, you need to listen.
Exactly.
And James Baldwin, at one point, he says I forget who he was referring to, but he doesn't know how Negroes live. And he says there's an apathy and an ignorance. And then he says, which is so utterly brilliant, that's what segregation really means.
Yes.
That is exclusion.
Yes.
Right?
You don't know what's behind the wall, and you don't need to know.
That's right.
You don't feel that you need to know. And this is eventually what people call white privilege.
Right.
But you could replace the adjective white by other thing. It's
sure.
just the attitude toward the other. We build walls around us, around our life, especially in time where you are in an economical danger. So Europe is building wall everywhere now. We don't want the foreigner. We don't want the migrants. Although you have created that migration in waging war in their country, so it's really about how do we relate to the other, and not only in terms of diversity or let's respect everyone's, but it's about also the economical part. Let's see how the wealth is distributed throughout the world. Does it make sense that certain countries just take 80% of the world wealth? This wealth is on the back of most of the rest of the world.
That's
of
right,
the majority.
Yeah.
So this type of apathy, it's part of it. It's an apathy that goes beyond race.
There's a I don't know if you know the French philosopher Emmanuel Levinas. Jewish philosopher, thinker, lost most of his family in Auschwitz. So he has a certain credibility, it seems to me. Very difficult to read. But he says, the face speaks, and what it says is thou shalt not kill. And that for him, he says, 20th century, all philosophy, all religion has failed because of where we're at today. And in a sense, your film, I think, says the same thing. How the hell did we end up here? How is it possible that knowing what we know? I mean, some of those images, Baldwin's comment about this is a quote brutal and humiliating fact. Close quote. I mean, I was brutally humiliated watching some of that film and saying, how have I been complicit in whatever way? Whether it's my silence or it's that I didn't raise the conversation around the Christmas dinner table. Because I was afraid, right? And I mean, I know that's what you want, and I know that's what you're getting at, and I know that's what James Baldwin was all about. But this sense, why can't we listen to others?
It's a human reaction that you tend to see the world only through your own eyes. You don't see it through the eyes of the other. You don't recognize the other, and especially in time of danger. You tend to retract to your group, to your family, to your partner, and the rest of the world. You don't care. You have to survive. And this is the wrong way to build a society. And at one point, the society will catch up with you. You cannot live your whole life in denial, in denying the other as well. And it's not even about, destroying the other. Even your silence is active.
Mm.
You know, and it's a great, you know, and we tend to forget that our so-called civilized world it's very thin, you know, and I study in Germany, and I each day I was in Germany, I never forget that maybe 50, 60 years from there, the most evolved society who gave us the greatest scientists, the greatest musicians, the greatest writers were actually putting people alive in crematorium.
Yeah, it's
you know, and it was a modernly planned. Yeah. It was mathematically planned. The big industries of the time help in killing millions of people. So we it's not far away. In the 60s, blacks were still lynched in the South and killed in the North. Because and today, when you see how intrinsic to the system itself, that young black people ends up in prisons or killed in the streets, this is today. And we are the most civilized, you know, country in the world, supposedly.
Do you think people leave the theater after seeing this? And I know that last night was the premiere. Hopeless, hopeful. Is there a sense of it's just too big? I mean, you've been working around the world for years, and your film, as you rightly mentioned before the recorder, was on Fatal Assistance, about development, about issues, and your comment mm-hmm. about how you don't think it works. Yeah, what is it?
I hope that people get out of the film conflicted.
Mm.
That they ask themselves questions. I hope that it moves them to. It's not about guilt. It's not about nice. You know what you did or did not. It's about what are you going to do.
It's about conviction, isn't
it? It's about knowing.
Mm.
It's about knowing, and as Baldwin says, it's about acknowledging something and decide what to do about it. That's what he says in the film. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
Because silence is criminal.
What's your role in this country and what's your future in it?
Exactly. Ask the real question, honestly, to yourself. And that's what we are taught not to do. And when he talks about the role of televisions, you know, that's the epiphany today. You can't watch, you know, I watch television all over the world. And watching television here in the United States, not only the fact that it's broke up with for commercial every 3 minutes or 5 minutes, you know, that how can you build a thought if you have to be, you know, stopped by commercial? You know, your brain cannot function properly, you know. So it's like you are fed constantly with material, with noise, with parasites.
Yeah.
And how can you sit back and think about yourself, who you are, in what society are you living, and find time to think about the other one on the other side, who is probably your brother, as Baldwin said, you know, flesh of my flesh.
Mm.
You know, we came from the same
mm-hmm.
roots.
Mm-hmm.
And black and white, and so the time and the space is not there anymore, and the industry makes sure that it's not there. You know, to sell your product, you need almost an empty head.
Right.
You know, that's what it is. I mean, there is a great French industrialist who owned the biggest TV channel in France. He basically said it in an interview. My job is to make sure that your head is empty so you can buy my products.
Buy more things.
Yes. So, of course, you know, how can you, you know, do some anything else, you know?
For you, you mentioned that, and I want to go a little deeper on this, you said it's not really about color. Is it about power? Is that it? Can you polarize it in that
sense? It's about class and it's about economics.
Mm.
It's about class. You know, and that's the interesting connection. Then when Baldwin talks about how Malcolm X and Martin Luther King became one before they died,
mm.
you know, that's when the system realized that they were really becoming dangerous. because they were leaving the space that they were allowed, which was the race question, the race issue. But when they understood that it goes beyond race, that it was economical, it was about poverty, whether you were black or white, that's where it became a problem for the establishment. So, and their next fight was a fight against poverty, both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. If you read the speeches of Martin Luther King 1 or 2 years before he was killed, it's incredible. It was not about peaceful demonstration. Mm. It was about changing the system economically. And this is when the establishment got scared. And that's where those two men came closer and became really dangerous. And so the civil rights movement, even though it was key and important and it changed a lot, but at some point the race discourse also kept you pinned down. Mm. Mm-hmm. And did not leave space for any other discussion.
Well, that's one of the points you're making, isn't it? That it's such a surface, almost superficial conversation that's going on.
Yes.
So you're kind of the deer in the headlights, almost, if you will, yeah. Because the emptiness.
Yes.
Right. We're not really getting to the issues. Yeah. We're not really peeling back.
And race is just the superficiality of it. It's painful for the one living it, but it's not just that reality. Mm. If myself as a man, I don't consider me first as a black person. I consider me as a human being, first and foremost. So, but you force me to see that I'm black.
Right.
You keep me in this issue, right, where I don't have time for this.
Right.
You know. I have other more important things,
yeah,
to think about, yeah, life, about other people, about other human beings, other countries, etc. And you try to keep me down in a discussion about prejudice, about segregation, and that's the danger of that long fight.
So what do you think, after all this time spending studying Baldwin and making the films you've made, what is it that acts as, and it's never one thing, but the catalyst to create a Martin Luther King, a Malcolm X, somebody that does, who is so deeply entrenched in the system, who can actually not only stand up and speak and write, but motivate and way beyond what a normal activist would be? Where does it come from?
Is
it
exactly.
Profound?
I mean, your question is exactly. Not the problem, but touches the reality. You have to imagine, like Baldwin says, when a young kid is 4, 5, 6, that's when he realizes that the world is very strange. Mm. Suddenly, he's not a kid, but he's a black kid.
Right.
So you live with it every day. It's not something like you intellectually at some point, you'd start thinking about it. You're confronted it with every person you meet in the street, every act you make in your social life, you're confronted with it. Is it the bus driver? Is it the subway station? Mm-hmm. Is it buying your bread? Is it you are constantly at very different level from even friendliness?
Sure.
It's not always aggressive, but the reflection is always about, I am somebody else.
I'm somebody else, yeah.
They see somebody else, which I am not. And that's a terrible feeling that you feel every day. That, again, to the expression white privilege that is very in mode right now, but that doesn't really explain everything. But it touches to that. When you're on the other side, your reality is a permanent reality. Mm. It's not something you get out of, you are permanently, even when you are among your peers, you talk about what's going on the other side. Or you talk about what you experience just 1 hour before. That's a daily occurrence. you know, and the situation makes sure that you never forget it, you know. And you know, I'm considered a privilege. You know, I live a privileged life because I travel, I speak languages, and I am accepted, and I can defend myself.
Mm.
But still, it's a daily occurrence where I am forced to think of myself as a black person. So it's not something I just, you know, it's not an intellectual thought.
Right.
You know, it's reality. You know, like Baldwin said, you know, when a nigger quotes the gospel, he's not quoting, he's telling you what happened to him today.
Right.
You know, that's, for me, it's resumed everything.
Samuel Jackson, I mean, obviously, I didn't know the man, James Baldwin, but wow, I mean, just immediately, not only the music and your, you know, the approach to the film drew me in, but his voice just seems like, I mean, he's so present,
yeah.
You know? I mean, I don't think that's an overstatement.
Yeah, no.
And you said in the Q&A that you shot it pretty quickly, and you didn't give him a lot of direction.
Yeah. No, I think he got it. It caught it. You know, reading this text, the text is so powerful.
Yeah, incredibly rich.
You know,
yeah.
That's, for me, that was the central part of the film. That's why I wanted to make this film. It's about this text. It's about what it says and how it says it. And it's literature, it's poetry, and it's reality at the same time. It's philosophy.
It absolutely is,
and it's politic, you know. So, and it's human. And Samuel Jackson, I think, you know, it's like a lot of us. It's about his life as well. And he knew that it was not about him. It was about Baldwin and what Baldwin was saying. So it, very humbly, and he got
right.
into that.
Felt you, the respect you don't, for the material.
You don't hear Samuel Jackson.
Mm.
You hear a man, a voice, a life, and you hear Baldwin.
You hear Baldwin. Yeah.
And that's a great...
it's pretty incredible.
Yes.
Yeah. So Baldwin said that he was terrified by the state of affairs 50 years ago. Would you echo that, in a sense, today? Still terrified, capital T?
Yes, no doubt. You know, people, how to say, underestimate the feeling of anger that one might feel every day. Now, you know, again, I'm a very privileged person, but I'm angry every day, just reading the newspaper.
Mm.
Hearing that another young black man or girl is killed for no reason, and it's just one little part. It's the maybe the most dramatic part, but it's happening on very different level from the most common to the most dramatic, and it's every day, and it's never ending. You know, and the reaction to it. You know, it's the same about the discussion about you know, weapons, about you know, the role of the NRA. You know, it's like, you know, how long can we talk about this? You know, when are we going to act? And the ignorance that is surrounding those issues. You know, that somebody can stand up today and say, I need my gun to defend myself, to defend my home.
It's something us Canadians don't really understand. That's
and the rest of the world. The rest of the world doesn't understand.
When it comes to guns, it's really quite...
What does it mean? What? I mean, in the history of this country, a history of violence, that somebody can steal 2016, hang on a gun like this, as if it's a phallus symbol. This is almost a psychological case, you know. And a whole big group of people in this country are ready to do whatever is necessary to keep their gun. And those are people basically in power, an organization that are spending a lot of money in the election and re-election of congressmen, of senators, of governors, of presidents, and we allow them this authority upon us. This is incredible.
Well, it's a form of madness, is what it is.
It becomes a form of madness. So and by the way, we come back to Baldwin. Mm. It's about profit. Mm. That's all it is. Again, it's about money. How much money I can make at the end of the day.
So how do you get out of bed in the morning? We got to wrap this up in a couple of minutes. Sadly, believe me,
I wish
we could go into the afternoon with this conversation. But
I am an author.
How do you stay hopeful?
I am a writer. I am a filmmaker. For me to have those issues, it's like I open a big safe every day and just choose my issue.
That's right. You know, it's like this pot of gold to work with.
Yeah, it's I'm privileged to do the what I do, and because at least I feel that I do something, I can do something, and that's my daily fight to find a form, to find an artistic form, to get conversation going, to get to fight this incredible ignorance that they are pushing us down to every day. They are preventing us to understand the world we are living in. So that's what I'm trying to do, and that's great to be able to do that.
To push back in that way.
Of course, yes.
It's funny that you look at that sort of disparity and so on as sort of that pot of gold at the end of the artistic rainbow,
oh, yeah.
As it
for,
were.
For an artist, you know, time of war and times of fight are a great moment.
Because I love that's the one, Raoul, just to wrap up, the lack of passionate conviction that Baldwin talks about and being misled, and I'm just going to toss this one out because I hope this provokes enough to this interview will provoke people to see the film. But we've been misled by numbers, which I think is amazing. I mean, talk about profit, talk about statistics. I mean, could we be more as what does he say? I couldn't believe it. Lame and empty and pathetic, I think, were the three words. I mean, wow. I mean, talk about a gavel coming down on the table in front of me, right? We're hypnotized by numbers.
Exactly.
It's
exactly.
All about this. Give me the stats. Give me the analysis. What does the evidence say? Who really gives a? Who cares? What is this actually? Is it going to make me a better husband? Is it going to make me a better teacher, a better friend, a better wife, a better friend? I think that's what.
And the numbers he means as well. The capitalistic numbers. Mm. Today it seems normal for a company to say we need 20% benefits.
Right.
We need profits every year. Every year, and this has to go higher. And we are ready to lay off 5,000 people just to have half a point more
right
on Wall Street.
Yeah.
And we accept that.
And we do it. We do accept it. It seems like there's this 9-to-5 ethic that
we're
okay
have people with. Who are earning $300 million a day. What can you do with $300 million? A day.
I say we spend the next 30 minutes trying to figure that out. Toronto International Film Festival. The film is I Am Not Your Negro, Raoul Peck. I thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been a real pleasure, and I appreciate your generosity. And I hope we can do a part two.
Well, I will do that with great pleasure.
Thank you.